Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm virtually here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello. I mean, hola.
There you go. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. This season, as Laura eats her way around Mexico, the two of us are coming together via the wonders of the internet to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and discussing the elite privilege of saying no to screens and graffiti's transition from outside the law to on trend. Laura, first things first, take us through what's the best thing you've eaten this week.
Oof. Such a big question. Yesterday I had the most delicious tacos de costilla, which is beef rib tacos with this like super tasty charred chili salsa. Oof, it was a dream, Jeremy.
It sounds like it. And yeah, I get physically tired looking at your Instagram stories and seeing all the dancing that is happening. So I,
that's,
you know,
like
you need to be
20% of the dancing, not even.
That's a lot of dancing.
I'm fueled
and
by
where
tacos.
Where are you today?
I'm again in my uncle's office. I have to take a photo this time to show you guys the view of Mexico City I have from the 11th floor up here. And to just, it's not the hot box. In fact, I'm actually quite cold. So it's quite a change for me from the original podcast setting.
And you're back after a detour in Cuba?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. We went to Cuba, which was just ridiculous and incredible. And I mean, I've been dreaming of going to Cuba my whole life, ever since my dad went when I was little. And then he promised he would take me for my 15th birthday. As you know, I'm now 26. So we're a little bit overdue, but we made it my like 15th birthday. That was kind of the gag the whole time, which was great because it was fun to celebrate, but also great because I didn't have to spend too much money. But yeah, Cuba's a crazy, amazing, wonderful place, and everyone should go there.
Fantastic.
How are you
Maybe
doing?
A bit more. How am I doing?
Yeah.
I'm fine. I was not in Cuba. I didn't do anything when I turned 15. I'm very, very cold, but I've got my vest.
I have it's a photo of you in your teenage years. I don't know if you're around 15, but I'm going to use it as blackmail if you ever cross me, Jeremy.
This is one of my goth photos.
It's one of your goth photos, yeah.
I think I proudly share that with you. Moving on, we're going to start with the first link of the week, which is from yours truly. It is titled, Human Contact is Now a Luxury Good. And I'm getting started with Old Faithful, the gray lady, aka the New York Times. And the subtitle of this piece, it says, screens used to be for the elite, now avoiding them is a status symbol. The piece is written by technology writer Nellie Bowles, is published in late March, and has been in my open tabs ever since, as it's a subject that I think is on a lot of people's minds these days. And I think for me, more so than ever, as my kids are starting to kind of get to the age where screens are in their lives more. And, you know, we're doing a lot of talking about that, me and my partner, about kind of how screens are kind of in their lives, both at home and in school and things like that. So obviously, this is something that is becoming a very topical issue at the moment. And just yesterday, actually, at the time we recorded it, the Times published a piece off the back of this new HBO show, Euphoria. Have you heard of the show at all, Laura?
Not until I saw this article everywhere.
So yeah, this is it's like a new show about kind of teens and the
I'm
subject
not up
is,
on teen or, culture, Jeremy.
Well, this is HBO culture. It's not TV, it's HBO.
Oh,
Laura,
I see.
As you know. But the title of this piece was The Euphoria Teenagers Are Wild, But Most Real Teenagers Are Tame. Kids these days are the cautious generation, the evidence shows. But a lot of the conversation that I've been kind of hearing around other parents, and you know, when I'm talking about this myself, is that the reason for this tameness is that most teens are actually just living in front of their screens now. So there's no actual time or motivation to do any of these things. And I think in some ways this article really kind of supports that. So yeah, an interesting kind of confluence of these kind of two pieces. But look, let me backtrack a bit here and give a bit of a brief rundown of the piece. So the crux of it is really the following statement, which I'm going to quote from. And she says, life for anyone but the very rich, the physical experience of learning, living, and dying is increasingly mediated by screens. The rich have grown afraid of screens. They want their children to play with blocks, and tech-free private schools are booming. Humans are more expensive, and rich people are willing and able to pay for them. Conspicuous human interaction, living without a phone for a day, quitting social networks and not answering email has become a status symbol. And this has led to a curious new reality. Human contact is becoming a luxury good. Now, this is obviously a gigantic issue. And Nellie does a really good job at kind of touching on the more salient points, from a screen-based avatar being used in aged care facilities to correlation of screen time to depression and other kind of mental illness. And much like the growing conversation on climate change, I think there's a growing concern on how we're all kind of just marinating in this new environment that is increasingly hard to kind of opt out of. And this is the first time I really considered the potential implications of screen time as a class issue in the same way that kind of climate change is being, I guess, positioned in some ways. I'm going to quote another piece that Nelly writes. She says, as wealthy kids are growing up with less screen time, poor kids are growing up with more. How comfortable someone is with human engagement could become a new class marker. There is also the reality that in our culture of increasing isolation, in which so many of the traditional gathering places and social structures have disappeared, screens are filling a crucial void. And this kind of, again, kind of overlaps with other things that we've been talking about here. And I've seen kind of in a lot of other kind of podcasts, you know, talking about kind of libraries and reemergence of libraries and these kind of civic structures and kind of these new, you know, or kind of reemergence of these kind of gathering places. So, of course, there's no easy answers here. But I think the more that I read pieces like this and I really understand the integrated effect that screens are having, I found it's actually had a really profound effect on both my personal and professional life. And I think, you know, for me, I don't know, there's been this, I don't know when it kind of happened, like maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, this kind of real kind of championing of this idea of the introvert. And that's kind of something that I've really identified with, you know, just kind of how I think in a way, after that, there was this kind of championing, and there still is like this idea of kind of the entrepreneur, you know, as kind of this kind of archetype. But I think I, even though I've always identified myself as an introvert, I find myself increasingly focusing on being more social and making real engagement a bigger part of my life. And I think in some ways with Jackie Winter, especially, we've always been doing this kind of unconsciously in some ways, like whether it's kind of gallery openings, creative mornings, life drawings. Like I've always tried to get people into my life professionally and kind of personally, because I think deep down, I know that my own tendencies are for introversion and that when I kind of give into that, I don't kind of feel good. And so it's always kind of something that I've kind of known unconsciously. And so I think we've always appealed to the side of things, and I think that's been to our benefit. But this idea of isolation is something that has real effects on our industry. And I've seen it happen like over kind of 12 years, like whether it's clients not willing to kind of meet with us and develop a real relationship, or a lot of artists kind of working on their own and kind of feeling lost and disconnected from community. And it's clear that there's kind of this growing trend that people have recognized and are now, I think, starting to reverse on how much of this, you know, is actually available to people who are not privileged. And I think Nelly uses a great fast food metaphor, which I really kind of connected with. And she says, just as skipping fast food is harder when it's the only restaurant offering in town, separating from screens is harder for the poor and middle class, even if someone is determined to be offline. That is not often possible, especially, you know, she talks about just how cheap screens are to make and how they're just becoming integrated with kind of everything. So, yeah, like, I don't want to kind of sound like too alarmist and, you know, in this kind of whole regard, but I think, yeah, there's some really amazing kind of points here. So, again, more questions than answers. I'm curious to hear your take, Laura. For me, I think even though I grew up with computers and somewhat of a digital native in this way, I still feel that I was able to eke out enough self-awareness to kind of know that things are not heading in a great direction. And now I have to kind of slowly reverse course. From the looks of things at the moment, you're having a very socially engaged time in your travels. Talking about Cuba, like, yeah, I want to hear more about this, but like, you know, I know that we were trying to plot this out and we actually had to plot it around the fact that internet is not great in Cuba. And you posted some photos of like kind of these public squares, like where you could kind of buy Wi-Fi in kind of these specific areas. So I thought that was a really interesting example. So do you see the same kind of class issues playing out in the places that you've been traveling? And, you know, what else do you think about this?
Oof, I mean, yeah, look, you said it. It's a hugely complex topic. And I think to put things incredibly simply, the increase in screens and the tech behind them has both obviously very positive and very negative effects, all of which totally intertwined and kind of impossible to tease out from one another. And I get really frustrated with people on both sides of that fence, you know, those who kind of denounce screens as the reason for society's downfall, and also those who kind of endlessly champion the benefits that screens bring to our lives. I think, like,
delicious,
like everything in this world and everything that we discuss on this show, for that matter, there is good and there is bad, and the good doesn't come without the bad and vice versa. And I think that's what makes this so incredibly tough, because like by choosing one path, be that more or less screens, you are kind of inevitably canceling out another, right? And the same tools that help us connect, provide healthcare, education, entertainment, they're the same tools that in some ways and for some people do just the opposite. But if you cut out the bad, you cut out the good as well. And I think it's important that people recognize that before they enter discussions like these. I think there's no simple answer to how much screen time or what sort is good or bad or even possible now. And increasingly we find ourselves using tech to solve problems that tech kind of created in the first place, which is not to say that the answer is necessarily to go back to the good old days, because A, that's not possible. And B, as I said before, if you cut out the bad progress, you kind of cut out the good as well. But I mean, look, all of that in mind, I think the way forward is likely, as you said, in kind of personal restrictions, right? Finding a balance between real world time and screen time that is healthy and practical for you and for your kids. But I think the whole point here and what this article and many others on this topic are really looking at is just how privileged an act that might be. And that's partly because the actual knowledge that excessive screen time might not be so good for us is really only just reaching your kind of average Jane or Joe, even though Silicon Valley families have been raising their kids screen free for years, you know, at the same time working damn hard to persuade others that screens are vital for them and for their kids. And then also partly because human interaction, at least when it comes to the provision of services. So again, talking about things like education and healthcare here, they're becoming far more expensive, leaving many with not much choice. And look, much of this article, as you mentioned, Jeremy, it centers on the use of that app from a company called Care Coach, which is this like animated cat that an elderly person can interact with on an iPad. And it's like monitored and controlled by workers in a faraway office somewhere. And to the writer's credit, this is the perfect example of this issue. You can have a flick through the comments on the article and they're fascinating. You just get a bit of an idea. There's many chastising this notion that something like Care Coach could replace human interaction and blasting the person's family and government for not providing more. And then there's others that are deeply grateful for the ability for their elderly family members to connect with the world that they can no longer reach by foot or by car in a time where there are probably few alternatives, you know, and they don't blame technology for that situation. They think that situation would have existed regardless. And I think this article is really good, but I think in some areas, and more I thought about it, I felt like I had a bit of a narrow view and one that was very Western-centric. And I think that's partly because it's nearly impossible to kind of really properly research the impact these things have on our lives. And also because kind of middle of the road sentiments like mine don't get any page views. But personally, I was thinking like, I mean, I do spend a lot of time on my phone and my computer, but I also spend an enormous amount of time interacting with real life human beings, be that at work, at home, at the shops, whatever. And if anything, and this of course is a statement purely on my personal experience, which says nothing about the experience of others, but I feel like I actually use my phone and computer as a welcome chance to retreat every now and then from the continuous physical connection with others. And I'm happy about that. And I don't feel like anything is out of balance. And I don't actively restrict my time with screens. And I also don't struggle for human interaction either. And of course, you know, in the spirit of the article, that might be a really key sign of my privilege, of which I undoubtedly have a lot of, but I'm certainly not the upper echelon of the elite that this article refers to. Depending on what sort of society you decide to place me in, I can sit anywhere from sort of lower to middle to upper middle class. And I associate personally with both ends of the spectrum and have at different times in my life all the different sort of ends of that spectrum that are discussed in pieces like this. And I think you'll find many societies in the world where the concerns of this piece ring very true, where human interaction is an indulgence for the elite. And on the flip side, I think there are many communities in which that's just not the case at all. I mean, you asked me about Cuba and I obviously can't speak to the complexities of the situation based on my week there, but it is an entirely different situation. I mean, for tourists, yeah, as I said, the only way that you can access internet is at these like special Wi-Fi parks or at hotels. And you buy a card and each card has an hour worth. It's like roughly like one American dollar for an hour worth of internet usage. And you have to sit there in that spot to use it. And side note, the internet was really, really good when you're in that spot, actually. But it's like, it's tropical and it's summer. So it's like suddenly torrential downpour and you have to run and you can't finish your email. But anyway, but for locals, there is full mobile internet access, but it is really expensive and the content is somewhat restricted. And for many other reasons, political and cultural, that we certainly obviously don't have time to go into here, the way that life is structured there means that the demand to be constantly connected isn't as strong as it might be, for example, in Australia. But then I look at a country like Mexico, which is again, a totally different situation, and internet is widespread and required for business, for life, everything. Although again, of course, not everywhere and for everyone, but there's still a very healthy balance of human interaction. And again, this speaks to my experience only, but I think that that has to do as well with cultural values, not just economics. And overall, I know that privilege and status and money all play a really big role here. And they're really, really important things to think about when we look at how tech companies kind of control our lives and the messages they put out and the long-term effects that has and short-term effects that has on everyone. But I think that the conversation around, for example, how screens affect a child's brain development and the conversation around how screens impact adult interaction or any of the other multitude of conversations you can have around this stuff, I think they're all really different. I think they're linked inherently, but different with disparate issues and causes and results. So lumping them together in the one conversation or article isn't helpful. It's helpful to get reads, but it doesn't necessarily break down the issue properly. And I think these issues are just too complex for a 2,000 word article or a 30 minute podcast. So again, I haven't answered your question all that well, but this is all the shit that goes through my brain when I read stuff like this.
Yeah, that's good to hear. And I think that's kind of what this is kind of, you know, the purpose of these pieces. I think it, you know, having this kind of, it's really about kind of having self-awareness and kind of understanding how, you know, how screen time does kind of affect you. And I really like how kind of you just spoke about, yeah, how you kind of do have this kind of good self-knowledge to kind of know, you know, where it kind of fits in your life. And I kind of think that's kind of a, you know, a good healthy thing to kind of have there, but I think not everybody has that. And I
but
kind
I don't,
of think,
that yeah, doesn't it's come a, from self-awareness. Like I've never thought about how does this fit into my life? It just naturally fell into place that way. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that might also be because you weren't, I mean, were kind of computers and screens kind of like what part did they play kind of in your upbringing as well?
Huge. Like, I mean, my dad, the programmer, and we always had computers in the house right from when I was born. And, you know, it was a huge, like all my early birthday presents were like coding things. So like, it's been a really
But there weren't kind of, you know, but the whole idea of kind of thinking like, you know, people like, I guess, yeah, looking at the age care model, and I'm sorry to interrupt, Laura, but yeah, like I kind of see where you're going there, but like in the aged care model is kind of really interesting. It's kind of almost like the exact opposite of how screens are being used now for kids, you know, the kind of as this kind of pacifier and a way to kind of, yeah, divert your attention kind of away from things that might be kind of unpleasant. And so I think the it's how it's kind of, I mean, obviously screen time with kids is a totally different issue that is kind of, this article doesn't really kind of touch on kind of in the same way, but I think there are, that's kind of what we need to kind of start thinking about like a lot more in kind of some ways. Cause like, I don't
well,
know.
That's
like,
probably what we have control over, to be honest. I guess like it sounds horrible to say, but it's like us and everyone older than us are probably lost cause now when it comes to screens. And if we're going to make any kind of lasting change or want to think about what kinds of changes we want to make, you have to, as always, start with the kind of youngest generations.
Exactly. But I mean, yeah, it's
save
it's
the
this,
children,
it's the same
Jeremy.
Kind of question that- Save the children.
They are our future.
There's our episode title for this week. Anyway, there's so much more we could get into. Yeah. But in our new slimmed down format, we can't afford to go into all the nooks and crannies here. But great piece. We'll put it in our show links as always and move on to our final link from there. Our second and final thing for the week. Laura, what do you have for us this week?
Oh, Jeremy, we are full on marching with the proletariat today, sticking with our lefty theme. And I've got a piece from the New Republic. It's a brief look at the commercialization of graffiti and the impact that that has on artists, communities, and companies. And it's titled How Graffiti Became Gentrified. And it's written by Daisy Eliotto. And as the article delves into, graffiti began obviously as this kind of democratic form of cultural expression with anti-establishment sentiments at its core. And they make reference to the amazing doco Style Wars from 1983, which for anyone who hasn't seen it, please go and watch it because it's just one of my all-time favorite pieces of film and an amazing record of New York in an era that I, you know, never ever got to see. But now for better and for worse, we're in this age of kind of murals, often paid for by brands and directed by their creative teams, many of which we at Jackie Winter work on ourselves and enjoy working on for many valid reasons. And they're all kind of, you know, completed with the required permits and permissions. And obviously there's a shift here in the nature of creation. And I wanted to raise the question of whether we think that graffiti and mural work still has a similar cultural or political impact in this kind of new climate, and whether both of those things can sort of exist separately from each other or what. But I think before we get into that, though, a few highlights from the article, which opens by discussing what happened at Five Points. And I'm pretty sure we talked about Five Points somewhere in season one, maybe, of this show. But for anyone who doesn't know, Five Points was a legendary graffiti venue in Queens, in New York. It was this kind of derelict warehouse that became a haven to graffiti artists in the early 2000s, thanks to an agreement that was struck with the building's owner, Jerry Wolkoff, who let artists use the massive exterior to paint whatever they wanted. And by the end, it featured over like 1,500 artists from all over the world before Wolkoff decided he wanted to sell off the land and convert it into condos. And of course, there was a massive uproar about this, but in the middle of the night, Wolkoff basically had the building whitewashed, and he painted over a decade's worth of artwork, an estimated 11,000 murals in just a few hours. So pretty intense. And the building has since been demolished, a new rootsy block constructed in its place. But where it gets really interesting is that in 2018, a court actually found Wolkoff liable for $6.75 million in damages to 21 different artists. And of course, this whole case was really big news because essentially you've got a federal court and jury. It was an actual jury trial deciding if graffiti A can be like categorized as art, which for a long time it hasn't been, or wasn't rather, and if it can be federally protected. And the settlement itself is under appeal, of course, but it was still hailed as a huge victory for the artists. But as the writer outlines, it also, and I quote, signaled a strange new chapter in the history of graffiti. In the early days, by creed, a graffiti artist would ask neither for permission nor compensation. Now, after courting the former, artists at Five Points were receiving the latter. Graffiti was once a countercultural threat that conservative forces roundly maligned as a racially coded stand-in for urban delinquency. It was an archenemy of both the New York Police Department and real estate developers for the supposed downward pull it exerted on property values. Now, graffiti had not only helped catalyze gentrification of one of the city's fastest growing neighborhoods, but was also being handsomely rewarded for it with legal recognition by a judge and jury. And I'm just kind of realizing now that this article is actually having kind of a similar conversation to the first link that we chatted about, because we're looking again at the progression of something that was once considered, you know, de classe, before, you know, talking about the idea of not using tech. And here we're talking about graffiti, and that's now been elevated to something of a status symbol, a signifier of money and taste. But of course, here the conversation is ever more complicated because you're tackling as well issues of race, appropriation, discrimination, depending on what angle you want to come at it from and how far back in graffiti's history you want to go. And of course, you know, there's this idea of graffiti has become street art, which is a term both kind of loved and hated by many. And I used to do a fair bit of art writing, and over the years I interviewed many, many graph artists for various projects, young and old, and in particular with those of an earlier generation, those who lived the more violent days of graffiti writing. There was a definite sense of repulsion even around that term, street art. And I think, you know, as with any cultural phenomenon that finds its way into the hands of those who were initially denying it, there are very complex feelings involved. And then there are also many people on the flip side with equally valid feelings and arguments, you know, about why it's a positive shift. And here we get to questions of value, of how much value of what and value to who, because as we've seen, street art can drive up property prices, but it can also generate income for those who create it, with those things kind of going hand in hand. And a market is created, and that benefits and damages people and things on both sides of the coin. And this concept of kind of selling out that some people sort of feel so strongly exists in this circumstance is often really boldly countered by the concept of fair gain by those who deserve it. And it's hard to see in any situation like this who's taking advantage of who, if anyone, and who's reaping what rewards, if any, or causing what problems. And despite that sort of clear increase in acceptance and commercialization of the art form, it's still very heavily policed. So it's again, a very complex situation. But towards the end of the article, they quote Mirzwan, who's the artist who struck the original deal with Wolkoff at Five Points. And he says, "The laws are the laws. If I could change anything, I'd do one legal paint park in each borough." And this is something that cities like London, Prague, Buenos Aires have done, and with success. But how that would change the nature of the relationship is still an open question, because in the meantime, there really aren't many viable options. And to quote Mirzwan again, he says, "I have no legal walls. I can't get up and say, I really feel like painting today. Now the options are a mural project that might be exploited, a paid commission, or nothing. If it wasn't for the wall in my yard, I'd go stir crazy." So, like, where does that leave us? Honestly, I'm not sure. Jeremy, maybe you could tell me, but this article highlights various interesting cases, a few of which that, you know, we've discussed on this show before, like the legal battle between the artist Revoke and H&M, where artists have kind of sought remuneration for their works being deliberately included in the backgrounds of ads. And I would love to hear your thoughts. I know neither of us are experts in this area whatsoever, but whether you feel like graffiti in the traditional sense should be protected and or compensated, and you know, how that plays into the kind of commercialization of it now.
Yeah, some really good questions here and a really interesting piece that, you know, is very kind of timely, as you say. And I think I was thinking about this a lot, and I think it's what's really hard, or where I kind of feel kind of uncomfortable talking about it, is because, like, there's so many kind of different practices that are kind of falling under this kind of big tent. And as you say, kind of we're involved in kind of in one state of it, in kind of, you know, in kind of one side of it. And, you know, much like other kind of things that were kind of very kind of underground and very kind of codified and had their own cultures, like tattooing, for example, you know, something you see something that's kind of gone so mainstream with kind of, you know, education and kind of tattoo camps and kind of all these kind of things you can do. And, like, you know, trying to maintain their kind of identity as a kind of a culture and as kind of a craft. And, like, you know, there's a lot of these kind of core questions of identity that are kind of wrapped up in there, especially when you look at tattooing as and something else that kind of is an analog to a commercial art, like a trade that you need to kind of make money from, as well as kind of being an art form and that has a tradition and has kind of this kind of lineage as well. So it's really interesting to consider. I think, you know, you have cases like Five Points and other kind of things like Banksy's, for example, where, you know, like what changes were kind of when something kind of goes in, when something kind of crosses over from being, you know, just kind of a piece into, like, you know, how many pieces on a building before now it becomes this kind of sacred space and sacred thing. How long does it have to be there? You know, or like, you know.
Well, because, for example, they weren't able to get like a heritage site ruling because it was less than 10 years old or something. A lot of the art was less than 10 years old. So they couldn't get rulings like that.
But obviously it was recognized because there was compensation. Like, you know, so that's the thing. There's a lot of these kind of more subjective kind of markers there. And I think, you know, it's really interesting that this piece kind of comes. I love how our kind of pieces link together, because one of the things that I've kind of been thinking about more and more is that these kind of really big public art pieces and these kind of, you know, these big murals and these big graffiti pieces, one of the reasons that they're so valuable is because they're done by humans. And yes. I kind of think that there's this whole idea, there's this human element. It's like, you know, someone actually kind of painted this wall, especially in, you know, a lot of our architecture now, the way that it kind of goes up, it feels inhuman. Like, it's a lot of glass. It's a lot of, you know, inorganic material. Obviously, I know the majority of, you know, there's some great architects who are kind of working against that. But yeah, like, you know, this kind of idea of there being this kind of human element to
and
our cities.
Not just human, but there are lots of things that are made by humans where you can't act, like, to the average person, you can't tell the amount of work that's gone into it. But anyone who can see a giant mural can sort of discern that, holy shit, that must have taken a long time, you know, at the least. And that is impressive.
It is, but I also kind of think there is a darker kind of side to it that kind of speaks to our overall, this whole culture at the moment of kind of bigger and more and like, you know, larger. And this whole idea of, especially with kind of property developers, it's kind of like, it's like the bigger something is. And like, and I don't get me wrong, like, I love seeing pieces at scale. Like, some of my favorite works at the moment are these things that are kind of really big, because, like, we talked about this when we talked about kind of land art as well. I love being kind of put into kind of physical perspective,
gosh, me
kind
too.
Of by
yeah.
these pieces. But I still doubt the actual motivations of the people who are kind of commissioning that, in terms of kind of them being kind of the status symbol, like, this is a big project.
Yeah.
Now,
I don't doubt the intentions of the artists that do them. I doubt the people funding it. But in the end, someone has to fund it, right? Especially for something that size. That's the tricky thing.
Yeah, it is tricky. And people need those kind of it's like, and it's not easy to kind of work on that scale. You know, like, it requires like a lot of, like, you know, yeah, like, you can't just get like a whole kind of building that you can kind of go and kind of practice on. Like, a lot
except
of it's kind
for
of,
five
you know,
points.
Learning, you know, as you go.
Well, that's what was so special about that spot. Exactly. Because that's so incredibly rare, that idea.
But I think, you know, like any other industry, like, you know, when it kind of grows, like, it needs to kind of start. I think it's important to have these kind of, for it to kind of start fracturing and splintering and having different conversations like around different things. And I think this is where it's going to kind of get dicey, because everything's kind of being lumped together here in this article in kind of some ways, where it's like, you know, you talk about property values. It's like, well, how much, like, say a property next to kind of commission flats that is just bombed or tagged out, you know, like, is that going to have the same property value as the same property that has a beautiful, huge mural kind of on the side of it, even if it's kind of done, you know, by a graffiti artist? So it's like, even though both of those things could essentially be called kind of graffiti or street art or what have you, you know, there's so many kind of different kind of connotations and different motivations and different, you know, and different kind of cultures that are involved with it.
Completely.
That I think, yeah, like, the different conversations.
Totally. And just to close out on that note, then, in the article at one point, and I can't remember right now who they are quoting, but so they're saying that, you know, as it becomes more commercialized, obviously people are kind of pushing the artwork and the art style to fit in with the styles that are already considered good art, you know? And I think that happens anytime something hits the mainstream or gets people in the mainstream want to sort of make use of that style, whether that's music, art, fashion, whatever, it gets kind of modified, or food, for example, you see so clearly where it gets modified to fit the palate, to fit the taste of the people that they want to sell it to, you know, and inevitably things fracture off. But as we talked about ages ago, we talked about zines with John Westenberg, and, you know, when the mainstream grabs a hold of it, that initial sort of subculture tends to fracture out even further, even deeper. And so I think obviously that's always going to be the case, but mainstream always catches up, and sometimes that's a bad thing and sometimes it's a good thing. It's just tricky.
It is, but I think, look, at the same time, the true innovators kind of that world, like, will find ways to rise to the top. Like, I think, you know, you look at kind of subway cars, for example, the reason that was kind of so innovative was, you know, they could, you know, there was that kind of daring feat of breaking to those yards and kind of doing it, but also this idea of this kind of different canvas. And I think that's always been the most interesting thing. It's like, yeah, what is, you know, what's the different, how, what is my canvas to kind of work on? And like, I think as our urban environments kind of change, people will kind of think about that a lot more differently. And you look at someone like Kaws, for example, Ryan Donnelly, you know, who is kind of he's been a very kind of old school, and obviously has had a major, I mean, he's always been kind of on this kind of ascendancy, but how his work kind of, you know, migrated from, you know, graffiti to kind of fine art, like, you know, to the toys that he does, and, you know, has all these kind of different things that he does, but still kind of, it still feels like graffiti kind of in this kind of interesting way. Or someone like the artist,
but I don't know how it might feel to someone who is deeper within that culture that we're not, but yeah.
Look, I just kind of, I think the practices and the craft, like, you know, will evolve, you know, as kind of our cities and kind of our spaces evolve, and kind of, yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing kind of what comes out of it next. So yeah, some great questions to pose there. Laura, thanks for bringing it to the table. As we're trying out in our new season, taking a bit of a page from our regular Open Tabs events, where we get four speakers taking 10 links, speaking for a minute each on each of those links, we're going through each of our other kind of browser tabs that were open that didn't kind of make the cut. I will start. There are three links that I've been kind of slowly picking through. One of them is from Kotaku, which is kind of a video game site, and it's an amazing series of interviews with people who worked on the Mortal Kombat series of games, and how, you know, and just like what it's like to actually work on these incredibly violent games, and just kind of, and living with that. And it was, man, it was shocking because it was so interesting, because the new Mortal Kombat came out, and like, I was always a real big Mortal Kombat fan, but I noticed that like my tolerance for kind of violence has gotten lower and lower as the years
go on. Probably after you had kids as well.
For many. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I kind of think, you know, it's, you know, there's almost a kind of comical quality of the violence that's kind of in these games. But I think, you know, because I'm such a visual person, like, and working in a visual industry, I'm very much more sensitive to kind of what I'm putting in. And so reading these articles about kind of how, you know, these guys, like, you know, this one guy said he couldn't look at a dog anymore without like visualizing its actual kind of insides completely and what it would look like, you know? Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. And I kind of think this is something we all need to kind of think about more in terms of the diets that we kind of feed ourselves kind of visually and textually and kind of all these ways. So I kind of think, even though it kind of superficially is, you know, not much, I think for creatives, really, it's interesting article from a bit of a different
industry. Because I can't watch TV, and I always thought it was annoying. Like, I can't watch TV without trying to break down in my head, like, how much did that ad cost to make? Well, how did they do it? Blah, blah. That is nothing compared to what these guys are dealing with.
Amazing. My second link, or a series of links, this is, I love like just end of year list, and like, I want them more. And so I'm loving this recent trend of kind of these mid-year lists that are kind of coming out now. So the AV Club is kind of doing their best of 2019 parentheses so far, which is great because I find my tastes really align with the AV Club. So, you know, they've got kind of from, you know, comedy, podcasts, music, films, everything, great mid-year list there. And my final link is a real estate agent in California called Hilton Highlands.
I love this website so much. I love this website so much, Jeremy.
Oh my God. It's basically just a list of properties they have for sale from their California office, and kind of also islands in Fiji and everything. And like, this is like, yeah, I don't want to say too much about it. I think you just need to kind of go through it. And like, if you're someone like me who just enjoys real estate porn, this is that to kind of the nth level. And if you want to know what $145 million will buy you,
you talk about upper echelon,
you can find out.
This is it. I used to spend hours on this website, and I'm so glad you brought it up because I completely forgot what the name was and I've never been able to find it again. And you've just like saved my life. That's great, Jeremy. Thank you.
Laura, what's in your open
chat? I got three as well. So the first one, I really love using Chrome as my browser, but more and more I'm having to kind of question whether it's okay to give Google that much access to my data. Blah. But I've been thinking about switching to Firefox, and my first link is just from their blog trying to convince me how easy it is to switch all my bookmarks and settings over, which I'm not so sure yet, but let's see. Check in with me next week. I might be on Firefox.
I tried it. Didn't work. I have lots of feelings about this, but yes, I tried it.
Jeremy. Well, my second link is much happier. It is a fairly new 6-part series by Defunctland, and it's all about Jim Henson and the Muppets. And I am such an enormous fan of both Jim Henson and of Defunctland. So it is like Christmas for me, and I am only halfway through right now, but I highly recommend it. I'm learning so much crazy fascinating stuff about Jim Henson, and it's so good. And if you haven't watched Defunctland before, that originally started as a YouTube series that like documents the history of extinct amusement park attractions, and it's so good. Anyway, my third link, I am very ashamed to admit, Jeremy, is New York Times crossword answers.com, because I got so frustrated with the Sunday puzzle that I had to look something up. And I discovered this website where this guy like chronicles all the answers for every New York Times crossword. And now I have to be very careful not to abuse this power. So anyway, I thought I'd unleash it on everyone else.
Thank you so much. And before we go, as we like to do every week, it is time for thumbs up, thumbs down, shaka. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the celestial off of our chest. Laura, thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you got?
Thumbs up for that. No, I've got a big thumbs up this week. We went to visit the house of Casa Luis Barragán, which is Luis Barragán is just one of the most sort of important figures, cultural figures in Mexico. He was a very interesting architect, and I've always been very interested in his work. But when I was coming to Mexico, asked for tips from lots of people what to do. So many people told me you have to go do the tour of Casa Luis Barragán, where he lived. And I thought, okay, it's a house tour, whatever. It's kind of expensive, and it just blew my mind. I never in my life have I seen a building with just so much thought put into every single aspect of how it would make you feel and behave in the space. And it's fascinating because he built lots of beautiful properties, but this is the one he built for himself. And after he built it, he lived there until he died. And so it's just really, really, it's bizarre and it's beautiful and it's fascinating. And if anyone's going to be in Mexico, you just absolutely have to do it. It's super worth it. What do you got?
Amazing. I got a shaka this week for eating almonds and pretzels together. Ooh. I'm all about mouthfeel at the moment. And like, you know, I was just talking about the other day how, yeah, like I wanted this pasta from Edo because
that's so good.
And like the bread. Yeah. When those two things kind of come together, it's so good. And I think, you know, the crispy kind of pretzel together, like with an almond, like it's like, if you can get like the ratio of pretzels to almond, right. It's a full shaka experience. So I think,
Since the first time I ate Edo, I've been making like giant batches in the oven. You just put panko breadcrumbs with olive oil and lots of chopped garlic, and you just let it crisp up in the oven, put it in a Tupperware, and then put it on every single thing that you eat ever. And your life will be sweet.
That's it for this week. I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. And if you want more of the podcast, archives of all of our shows and links can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Or you can sign up to our newsletter that we send out every week that has all the links and other Jackie Winter-related content at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, that's jwg.is/newslettering. You can find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And email us with anything at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content as we rev it on. And if you work from an ad agency or design studio and interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye. Oh,
you, do you think we need to see each other? Is that part of what made it hard for you last time?
No, no. I would prefer not to look at you, actually.
Wow. 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 Fucking rude.